This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Pretty Baby by Mary Kubica. This book is read by Cassandra Campbell, Tom Taylorson, and Georgina Marie. For the Ones I've Lost.
Heidi. The first time I see her, she is standing at the Fullerton station on the train platform, clutching an infant in her arms. She braces herself and the baby as the Purple Line Express soars past and out to Linden. It's the 8th of April, 48 degrees and raining. The rain lurches down from the sky, here, there, and everywhere, the wind untamed and angry. A bad day for hair. The girl is dressed in a pair of jeans, torn at the knee. Her coat is thin and nylon, an army green. She has no hood, no umbrella. She tucks her chin into the coat and stares straight ahead while the rain saturates her. Those around her cower beneath umbrellas, no one offering to share. The baby is quiet, stuffed inside the mother's coat like a joey in a kangaroo pouch. Tufts of slimy pink fleece sneak out from the coat, and I convince myself that the baby, sound asleep in what feels to me like utter bedlam, chilled to the bone, the thunderous sound of the L soaring past, is a girl. There's a suitcase beside her feet, vintage leather, brown and worn, beside a pair of lace-up boots, soaked thoroughly through. She can't be older than 16. She's thin, malnourished, I tell myself, but maybe she's just thin. Her clothes droop. Her jeans are baggy. Her coat too big. A CTA announcement signals a train approaching, and the Brown Line pulls into the station. A cluster of morning rush-hour commuters crowd into the warmer, drier train. But the girl does not move. I hesitate for a moment, feeling the need to do something, but then board the train like the other do-nothings, and slinking into a seat, watch out the window as the doors close and we slide away, leaving the girl and her baby in the rain. But she stays with me all day. I ride the train into the loop, to the Adams Wabash station, and inch my way out, down the steps and onto the waterlogged street below, into the acrid sewage smell that hovers at the corners of the city streets, where the pigeons amble along in staggering circles, beside garbage bins and homeless men and millions of city dwellers rushing from point A to point B in the rain. I spend whole chunks of time, between meetings on adult literacy and GED preparation and tutoring a man from Mumbai in ESL, imagining the girl and child wasting the better part of the day on the train's platform, watching the L come and go. I invent stories in my mind. The baby is colicky and only sleeps in flux. The vibration of approaching trains is the key to keeping the baby asleep. The woman's umbrella, I picture it, bright red with flamboyant golden daisies, was manhandled by a great gust of wind, turned inside out, as they tend to do on days like this. It broke. The umbrella, the baby, the suitcase. It was more than her two arms could carry. Of course, she couldn't leave the baby behind. And the suitcase? What was inside that suitcase that was of more importance than an umbrella on a day like this? Maybe she stood there all day, waiting. Maybe she was waiting for an arrival rather than a departure. Or maybe she hopped on the red line seconds after the brown line disappeared from view. When I come home that night, she's gone. I don't tell Chris about this because I know what he would say. Who cares? I help Zoe with her math homework at the kitchen table. Zoe says that she hates math. This comes as no surprise to me. These days, Zoe hates most everything. She's 12. I can't be certain, but I remember my I hate everything days coming much later than that, 16 or 17. But these days everything comes sooner. I went to kindergarten to play, to learn my ABCs. Zoe went to kindergarten to learn to read, to become more technologically savvy than me. Boys and girls are entering puberty sooner, up to 2 years sooner in some cases than my own generation. 10-year-olds have cell phones. 7- and 8-year-old girls have breasts. Chris eats dinner and then disappears to the office, as he always does, to pore over sleepy, coma-inducing spreadsheets until after Zoe and I have gone to bed. The next day she's there again. The girl. And again, it's raining. Only the second week of April, and already the meteorologists are predicting record rainfall for the month. The wettest April on record, they say. The day before, O'Hare reported 0.06 inches of rain for a single day. It's begun to creep into basements, collect in the pleats of low-lying city streets. Airport flights have been canceled and delayed. I remind myself, April showers bring May flowers. Tuck myself into a creamy waterproof parka and sink my feet into a pair of rubber boots for the trek to work. She wears the same torn jeans, the same army green jacket, the same lace-up boots. The vintage suitcase rests beside her feet. She shivers in the raw air, the baby writhing and upset. She bounces the baby up and down, up and down, and I read her lips. Shh. I hear women beside me, drinking their piping hot coffee beneath oversized golf umbrellas. She shouldn't have that baby outside. On a day like today, they sneer. What's wrong with that girl? Where is the baby's hat? The Purple Line Express soars past. The Brown Line rolls in and stops, and the do-nothings file their way in like the moving products of an assembly line. I linger, again, wanting to do something, but not wanting to seem intrusive or offensive. There's a fine line between helpful and disrespectful, one which I don't want to cross. There could be a million reasons why she's standing with the suitcase, holding the baby in the rain. A million reasons other than the one nagging thought that dawdles at the back of my brain. She's homeless. I work with people who are often poverty-stricken, mostly immigrants. Literacy statistics in Chicago are bleak. About a third of adults have a low level of literacy, which means they can't fill out job applications. They can't read directions or know which stop along the L track is theirs. They can't help their children with their homework. The faces of poverty are grim. Elderly women curled into balls on benches in the city's parks. Their life's worth pushed around in a shopping cart as they scavenge the garbage for food. Men pressed against high-rise buildings on the coldest of January days. Sound asleep, a cardboard sign leaned against their inert body. Please help. Hungry. God bless. The victims of poverty live in substandard housing, in dangerous neighborhoods. Their food supply is inadequate at best. They often go hungry. They have little or no access to health care, to proper immunization. Their children go to underfunded schools, develop behavioral problems, witness violence. They have a greater risk of engaging in sexual activity, among other things, at a young age, and thus the cycle repeats itself. Teenage girls give birth to infants with low birth weights. They have little access to health care. They cannot be properly immunized. The children get sick. They go hungry. Poverty in Chicago is highest among blacks and Hispanics. But that doesn't negate the fact that a white girl can be poor. All this scuttles through my mind in the split second I wonder what to do. Help the girl. Get on the train. Help the girl. Get on the train. Help the girl. But then, to my surprise, the girl boards the train. She slips through the doors seconds before the automated announcement. Bing bong, doors closing. And I follow along, wondering where it is that we're going. The girl, her baby, and me. The car is crowded. A man rises from his seat, which he graciously offers to the girl. Without a word, she accepts, scooting into the metal pew beside a Wheeler dealer in a long black coat. A man who looks at the baby as if it might just be from Mars. Passengers lose themselves in the morning commute. They're on their cell phones, on their laptops and other technological gadgets. They're reading novels, the newspaper, the morning's briefing. They sip their coffee and stare out the window at the city skyline, lost in the gloomy day. The girl carefully removes the baby from her kangaroo pouch. She unfolds the pink fleece blanket, and miraculously, beneath that blanket, the baby appears dry. The train lurches toward the Armitage station, soaring behind brick buildings and 3 and 4 flats. So close to people's homes, I imagine the way they shake as the L passes by. Glasses rattling in cabinets, TVs silenced by the reverberation of the train. Every few minutes of the livelong day and long into the night. We leave Lincoln Park and head into Old Town. And somewhere along the way, the baby settles down, her wailing reduced to a quiet whimper to the obvious relief of those on the train. I'm forced to stand farther away from the girl than I'd like to be. Bracing myself for the unpredictability of the train's movements, I peer past bodies and briefcases for the occasional glimpse. Flawless ivory skin, patchy red from crying. The mother's hollow cheeks. A white onesie's jumpsuit. The desperate, hungry suction on a pacifier. Vacant eyes. A woman walks by and says, "Cute baby." The girl forces a smile. Smiling does not come naturally to the girl. I imagine her beside Zoe and know that she is older. The hopelessness in her eyes, for one. The lack of Zoe's raw vulnerability, another. And, of course, there is the baby. I have myself convinced that Zoe still believes babies are delivered by storks, though beside the businessman the girl is diminutive, like a child. Her hair is disproportional, cut blunt on one side, shoulder-length the other. It's drab, like an old sepia photograph, yellowing with time. There are streaks of red, not her natural hue. She wears dark, heavy eye makeup, smeared from the rain, hidden behind a screen of long protective bangs. The train slows its way into the loop, careening around twists and turns. I watch as the baby is swaddled once again in the pink fleece and stuffed into the nylon coat, and prepare myself for their departure. She gets off before I do, at State Van Buren, and I watch through the window, trying not to lose her in the heavy congestion that fills the city streets at this time of day. But I do anyway, and just like that, she's gone.
Chris. "How was your day?" Heidi asks when I walk in the front door. I'm greeted by the funky scent of cumin, the sound of cable news from the living room TV, Zoe's stereo blasting down the hall. On the news, record rainfall clobbering the Midwest. An accumulated collection of wet things resides by the front door, coats and umbrellas and shoes. I add to the collection and shake my head dry, like a wet dog. Moving into the kitchen, I plant a kiss on Heidi's cheek, more a force of habit than something sweet. Heidi has changed into her pajamas already, red flannel and plaid, her hair with its natural auburn waves deflated from the rain. Contacts out, glasses in. "Zoe!" she yells. "Dinner's ready!" Though, down the hall, between the closed door of our daughter's bedroom and the deafening sound of boy band music, there's no chance she heard. "What's for dinner?" I ask. "Chili."
"Zoe!"
I love chili. But these days, Heidi's chili is a vegetarian chili, loaded with not only black beans and kidney beans and garbanzo beans and, apparently, cumin, but also what she calls vegetarian meat crumbles, to give the impression of meat without the cow. She snatches bowls from the cabinet and begins ladling the chili. Heidi is not vegetarian, but since Zoe began ranting about the fat in meat 2 weeks ago, Heidi made the family decision to go meat-free for a while. In that time, we've had vegetarian meatloaf and spaghetti with vegetarian meatballs and vegetarian sloppy joes. But no meat. "I'll get her," I say, and head down the narrow hall of our condo. I knock on the pulsating door and, with Zoe's blessing, poke my head inside to tell her about dinner, and she says okay. She's lying on her canopy bed, a yellow notebook, the one with all the teeny bopper celebs she's torn from magazines taped to the front, on her lap. She slams it shut the minute I enter, gropes for social studies flashcards which lie beside her, ignored. I don't mention the crumbles. I trip over the cat on my way to Heidi's and my bedroom, loosening my tie as I do. Moments later, we sit at the kitchen table, and again Heidi asks me about my day. "Good," I say. "You?"
"I hate beans,"
Zoe declares as she scoops up a spoonful of chili and then lets it dribble back into the bowl. The living room TV is muted, yet our eyes drift toward it, trying our best to lip-read our way through the evening news. Zoe slumps in her chair, refusing to eat, a cloned version of Heidi, from the roundness of their faces to the wavy hair and brown eyes, everything alike, down to their cupid's bow lips and a handful of freckles splattered across their snub noses.
"What did you do?"
Heidi asks, and internally I grimace, not wanting to relive the day, and her stories, Sudanese refugees seeking asylum and illiterate grown men, are depressing. I just want to lip-read my way through the evening news in silence. But I tell her anyway about a customer due diligence call and drafting a purchase agreement and a ridiculously early conference call with a client in Hong Kong. At 3 a.m., I sneaked from the bedroom that Heidi and I share and crept into the office for the call. And when it was finished, I showered and left for work, long before Heidi or Zoe began to stir. "I'm leaving in the morning for San Francisco," I remind her. She nods her head.
"I know. How long?"
"One night." And then I ask her about her day, and Heidi tells me about a young man who emigrated from India to the United States 6 months ago. He was living in the slums of Mumbai. Dharavi, to be exact, one of the largest slums in the world, as Heidi tells me, where he was earning less than $2 American a day in his home country. She tells me about the toilets, how they're few and far between. The residents use the river instead. She's helping this man, she calls him Akar, with his grammar, which isn't easy. She reminds me, "English is a very difficult language to learn." I say that I know. My wife is a bleeding heart, which was absolutely adorable when I asked her to marry me. But somehow after 14 years of marriage, the words immigrant and refugee hit a nerve for me, generally because I'm sure she's more concerned with their well-being than my own.
"And your day, Zoe?"
Heidi asks.
"It sucked,"
Zoe grumbles, slumped in the chair, staring at that chili as though it just might be dog shit. And I laugh to myself. At least one of us is being honest. I want a do-over. My day sucked, too.
"Sucked how?"
Heidi asks. I love when Heidi uses the word sucked. Its unnaturalness is comical. The only time Heidi talks about things sucking is in reference to a lollipop or straw. And then,
"What's wrong with your chili? Too hot?"
"I told you, I hate beans."
5 years ago, Heidi would have reminded her of the starving children in India or Sierra Leone or Burundi. But these days, just getting Zoe to eat anything is an accomplishment. She either hates everything or it's loaded with fat, like meat. And so, instead, we eat crumbles. From the recesses of my briefcase, sitting on the floor beside the front door, my cell phone rings. And Heidi and Zoe turn to me, wondering whether or not I'll abscond with the phone in the middle of dinner to my office, the third bedroom we converted when it was clear there would be no more children for me and Heidi. I still catch her sometimes, when she's in the office with me, her eyes roving along espresso office furniture. A desk and bookshelves, my favorite leather chair. Imagining something else entirely. A crib and changing table. Playful safari animals prancing on the walls. Heidi always wanted a big family. Things just didn't work out that way. It's rare that we get through a quick dinner without the obnoxious sound of my cell. Depending on the night, my mood, or, more important, Heidi's mood, or whatever emergency cropped up at work that day, I may or may not answer it. Tonight, I stuff a bite of chili into my mouth as a rebuttal, and Heidi smiles sweetly, which I take to mean, thank you. Heidi has the sweetest smile, sugar-coated and delicious. Her smile comes from somewhere inside, not just planted on those Cupid's bow lips. When she smiles, I imagine the first time we met, at a charity ball in the city, her body cloaked in a strapless vintage tulle dress, red, like her lipstick. She was a work of art, a masterpiece. She was still in college, an intern at the nonprofit she now all but runs. Back in the days when pulling an all-nighter was a piece of cake, and 4 hours of sleep was a good night for me. Back in the days when 30 seemed old, so old in fact that I didn't even consider what 39 would be like. Heidi thinks that I work too much. For me, 70-hour work weeks are the norm. There are nights I don't get home until 2 o'clock. There are nights I'm home, but locked in my office until the sun begins to rise. My phone rings at all hours of the day and night, as if I'm an on-call physician and not someone who deals with mergers and acquisitions. But Heidi works at a non-profit agency. Only one of us is making enough money to pay for a condo in Lincoln Park, to cover Zoe's expensive private school tuition and save for college. The phone stops ringing, and Heidi turns to Zoe. She wants to hear more about her day. It turns out that Mrs. Peters, the seventh-grade earth science teacher, wasn't there, and the sub was a total... Zoe stops herself, thinks of a better adjective than the one implanted in her brain by misfit preteens. A total nag. Why's that? Heidi asks. Zoe avoids eye contact, stares at the chili. I don't know. She just was. Heidi takes a sip of her water, plants that big-eyed, inquisitive look on her face. The same one I got when I mentioned the 3 a.m. call. She was mean? Not really. Too strict? No. Too ugly? I throw in to lighten the mood. Heidi's need to know sometimes puts a strain on things. She's convinced herself that being an involved parent, and by this I mean over-involved, will assure Zoe that she's loved as she enters into what Heidi calls the tumultuous teenage years. What I remember from my own tumultuous teenage years was the need to escape my parents. When they followed, I ran faster. But Heidi has taken out books from the library. Psychology books on child development, parenting with love, secrets of a happy family. She's bound and determined to do this right. Zoe giggles. When she does, and it doesn't happen often, she becomes 6 again, consummately pure, 24-karat gold. No, she answers. Just a nag, then? A nasty old nag? I suggest. I push aside the black beans and look for something else. A tomato, corn, a chili scavenger hunt. I avoid the vegetarian meat crumbles.
Yeah, I guess so.
What else? Heidi asks.
Huh?
Zoe's got on a tie-dye shirt with the words peace and love written in hot pink. It's covered in glitter. She's got her hair in this side ponytail thing that makes her look too sophisticated for the tangerine braces that line her rambling teeth. She's drawn all over her left arm. peace signs, her own name, a heart, the name Austin. Austin?
What else sucked?
Heidi asks. Who the hell is Austin?
Taylor spilled her milk at lunch, all over my math book. Is the book okay?
Heidi wants to know. Taylor has been Zoe's best friend, her bestie, her BFF, since the girls were about 4. They share matching BFF necklaces, skulls, of all things. Zoe's is lime green and draped around her neck at all times, day or night. Her mother, Jennifer, is Heidi's best friend. If I remember correctly, they met at the city park, 2 little girls playing in the sandbox, their mothers taking a breather on the same park bench. Heidi calls it happenstance. Though, I believe in reality, Zoe threw sand in Taylor's eye, and those first few moments weren't so fortunate after all. If it hadn't been for Heidi with her spare water bottle to wash off the sand, and if Jennifer hadn't been in the midst of a divorce and desperate for someone on whom to unload, the story might have had a very different ending. Zoe replies,
I don't know. I guess so. Do we need to replace it?
No comment.
Anything else happen? Anything good?
She shakes her head. And that, in a nutshell, is Zoe's sucky day. Zoe is excused from the table without eating her chili. Heidi convinces her to take a few bites of a cornbread muffin and finish a glass of milk, and then sends her to her room to finish her homework, leaving Heidi and me alone. Again, my cell phone rings. Heidi jumps up to start the dishes, and I linger, wondering whether or not I've been excused. But instead I grab some dishes from the table and bring them to Heidi, who's dumping Zoe's chili down the garbage disposal. The chili was good. I lie. The chili was not good. I stack the dishes on the countertop for Heidi to rinse and hover behind her, my hand pressed to plaid red flannel.
Who's going to San Francisco?
Heidi asks. She turns off the water and turns to face me, and I lean into her, remembering what it feels like when I'm with her, a familiarity so ingrained in us both. It's natural, habit, second nature. I've been with Heidi for almost half my life. I know what she's going to say before she says it. I know her body language, what it means. I know the inviting look in her eye when Zoe is at a sleepover or long after she's in bed. I know that now, as she slips her arms around me and pulls me into her, locking her hands around the small of my back. It isn't an act of affection. It's one of ownership. You are mine. Just a couple of people from the office, I tell her. Again, with the big inquisitive eyes. She wants me to elaborate. Tom, I say. And Henry Tomlin. And then I hesitate, and it's probably the hesitation that does me in. Cassidy Knudsen, I admit meekly, throwing in the last name as if she doesn't know who Cassidy is. Cassidy Knudsen, with the silent K. And with that, she removes her hands and turns back to the sink. It's a business trip, I remind her. Strictly business, I say as I press my face into her hair. It smells like strawberries, sweet and juicy, combined with a hodgepodge of city smells, the dirtiness of the street, strangers on the train, the musty scent of rain. Does she know that? Heidi asks. I'll be sure to tell her, I respond. And when the conversation goes quiet, the room silenced except for the indelicate propulsion of dishes into the dishwasher, I seize my opportunity to slip away, wandering into the bedroom to pack. It isn't my fault I have a co-worker who's nice on the eyes.
Heidi. When I wake in the morning, Chris is gone. Beside me, on the distressed wooden nightstand, is a mug of coffee, tepid and likely filled to the gills with hazelnut creamer, but still, coffee. I sit up in bed and reach for the mug and the remote control, and flipping on the lifeless TV, stumble upon the day's forecast. Rain. When I finally wobble down the hall to the kitchen, bypassing Zoe's school portraits from kindergarten through 7th grade, I find her standing in the kitchen, pouring milk and cereal into a bowl. Good morning, I say, and she jumps. Did you sleep okay? I ask, and kiss her gingerly on the forehead. She congeals, uncomfortable with the mushy stuff these days. And yet, as her mother, I feel the need to show my affection. A high five, or secret handshake, as Chris and Zoe share, simply won't do. So I kiss her and feel her pull away, knowing I've planted my love for the day. Zoe's dressed already in her school uniform, the pleated plaid jumper and navy cardigan, the suede Mary Janes that she hates. Yeah, she says, and takes her bowl to the kitchen table to eat. How about some juice? I'm not thirsty. Though I see her eye the coffee maker nonetheless, a door that she previously opened and I firmly closed. No 12-year-old needs a stimulant to get going in the morning. Yet I fill my mug to the brim and douse it with creamer, sit beside Zoe with a heaping bowl of raisin bran, and attempt to make small talk about the anticipated day. I'm inundated with yeses, noes, and I don't knows, and then she scampers away to brush her teeth. And I'm left with the silence of the kitchen, the steady percussion of raindrops on the bay window. We head out into the soggy day, bypassing a neighbor in the hall. Graham. He's pressing at buttons on a snazzy watch, the gadget letting out various beeps and bleeps. He smiles to himself, clearly pleased. Fancy meeting you here, ladies, he warbles with the most decadent smile I've ever seen. Graham's longish blonde hair flops against a glossy forehead, strands that will soon be fully erect thanks to a generous supply of gel. He's wet, though from rain or perspiration I honestly can't say. Graham is heading home from a morning run along the lakefront in his head-to-toe Nike attire, an overpriced watch that tracks mileage and splits. His clothing matches entirely too well. A lime green stripe in his jacket to match the lime green stripe in his shoe. He's what one would call metrosexual, though Chris feels certain there's more to it than that. Morning, Graham, I say. How was the run? Leaning against the wheat-colored walls with their white wainscoting, he squirts a swig of water into his mouth and says, Incredible. There is a look of euphoria on his face that makes Zoe blush. She glances down at her shoes, kicks invisible dirt from one shoe with the toe of another. Graham is a 30-something orphan living in this building because the unit next door to theirs was left to him in his mother's will when she died years and years ago, and Graham consequently made out like a bandit, acquiring not only his mother's inheritance, but hundreds of thousands of dollars in a hospital settlement as well, money that he slowly squandered away on fancy watches, expensive wines, and lavish home decor. Graham planned to put the home on the market after his mother died, but instead he moved in. Moving vans replaced all of her eclectic furniture and belongings with Graham's modern ones. So sleek and stylish, it was as if he'd climbed from the pages of a Design Within Reach catalog. The crisp lines and sharp angles, the neutral colors. He was a minimalist. The condo sparse, but for sheets and sheets of computer paper that littered the floor. Gay, Chris assured me after we'd stepped foot in Graham's new condo for the first time. He's gay. It wasn't only the home decor that caught Chris's eye, but the closets full of clothes, more clothes than even I owned, that he left purposefully open so we would see. Mark my words, you'll see. And yet, women came to call quite regularly. Stunning women that left even me speechless. Women with bleach blonde hair and unnaturally blue eyes, with bodies like Barbie dolls. Graham had arrived when Zoe was still a toddler. She took to him like fruit flies to a bowl of browning bananas. As a freelance writer, Graham was often home, staring blankly at a computer screen and overdosing himself on caffeine and self-doubt. He came to our rescue more than once when Zoe was ill and neither Chris nor I could miss work. Graham welcomed her onto his tufted sofa, where together they watched cartoons. He is a go-to when in need of a cup of butter, a dryer sheet, or someone to hold the door. He's also top-notch at expository writing, helping Zoe with English homework when neither Chris nor I could. He's an expert at dressing a turkey, something I learned that I couldn't do 3/4 of the way through cooking Thanksgiving dinner for in-laws. In short, Graham is a good friend. "You two should join me sometime," Graham says about the run. I see the multitude of water bottles harnessed to his waist and think we best not. "You'd be sorry if I did," I say, watching as Graham tousles Zoe's hair, and again she blushes, this time the rosy tint having nothing to do with his sexual innuendos. "What about you?" he says to Zoe, and she shrugs. Being 12 has its advantages. The fact that a shrug and a shy smile can get her off the spot. "Think about it," he says, flashing that decadent smile, the teeth lined in a row like well-behaved schoolchildren, impeccably white. The insinuation of facial hair where he has yet to shave, the downturned eyes, which Zoe avoids like the plague. Not because she doesn't like him, but because she does. We say our goodbyes and head out into the rain. I walk Zoe to school before continuing on to work. Zoe attends the Catholic school in our neighborhood, nestled beside a cumbersome Byzantine church, with its gray brick exterior, its heavy wooden doors, its heavenly dome that reaches to the sky. The church is entirely ornate. From the golden murals that run wall to wall, to the stained glass windows and marble altar. The school sits behind the church, tucked away. A regular brick school building with a playground and a mass of children in matching plaid uniforms hidden beneath multicolored raincoats, their backpacks too obese for their tiny bodies. Zoe slips away from me with barely a goodbye, and I watch from the curb as she unites with other seventh graders and hurries from the waterlogged street into the dry building, staying away from the little ones, those clinging to parents' legs and vowing that they don't want to go, as if they have some communicable disease. I watch until she is in the building, and then continue on my way to the Fullerton station. At some point along the way, the rain, with all of its urgency, turns to hail, and I find myself running gracelessly down the street, my feet stomping through puddles, splashing dirty rainwater upon my legs. The girl and her baby come to mind, and I wonder if they, too, are somewhere out there being pelted by rain. When I arrive at the station, I use my fare card to unlock the turnstile, then dash up the slippery steps. Wondering if I will see them, the girl and her baby, but they are not there. Of course, I'm grateful that the baby and her mother are not on the platform in this atrocious weather. But my mind begins to wander. Where are they? And more important, are they safe? Are they dry? Are they warm? It's the definition of bittersweet. I wait impatiently for the train, and when it arrives, I get on, my eyes anchored to the window, half expecting to see the two appear at any second. The army green coat and lace-up boots, the vintage leather suitcase and sodden pink fleece blanket, the baby's exposed creamy head with faint, delicate plumage, the baby's toothless smile. At work, a third-grade field trip arrives at our literacy center. With a handful of volunteers, we read poetry to the students, and then the students try their hand at writing and illustrating some poetry of their own, which the more adventurous of the bunch share with the group. The students coming to the center are mostly from lower-class urban neighborhoods, mostly African-American or Latino. Many are from low-income homes, and a smattering speak something other than English, Spanish, Polish, Chinese in the home. Many of these children come from families where both parents work, if both parents are still around. Many are from single-parent homes. Many are latchkey kids who spend their afternoons and evenings alone. They are overlooked for more pressing matters, food and housing, to be exact. A morning at our facility is about more than literacy and developing a love of sonnets and haiku. It's about the doubt that overtakes the children when they walk in our doors, quietly grumbling about the task at hand, and the fortitude with which they leave after a few hours of hard work and the undivided attention of our staff. But once they're gone, thoughts of the girl and her baby return. The rain has quieted to a needless drizzle when lunchtime comes. I fasten my raincoat and head outside, careening down State Street while feasting on some healthy granola bar in lieu of lunch, heading to the library to pick up a book I have on interlibrary loan. I absolutely love the library, with its sunlit atrium, though not sunlit today, and grotesque granite gargoyles and millions of books. I love the quietness of the library, the gateway to knowledge, to the French language and medieval history and hydraulic engineering and fairy tales, learning in a very primitive form. Books. Something that's quickly giving way to modern technology. I pause beside a homeless woman leaning against the red brick building and set dollar bills in her outstretched hand. When she smiles at me, I see that many of her teeth are missing, her head covered in a thin black hat that's supposed to keep her warm. She mumbles a thanks, inarticulate and hard to understand, what teeth she has blackened from what I take to be methamphetamine use. I find my book on the hold shelf and then take a series of escalators up to the 7th floor, bypassing security guards and elementary school field trips, wandering vagrant men and women with other women talking too loudly for the library. The library is warm and calm, and entirely welcoming as I make my way to the literature aisle in search of something enjoyable to read, the latest New York Times bestseller. And it's there that I see her, the girl with her baby, sitting cross-legged on the ground in the midst of the literature aisles, the baby laid across her lap, its head elevated by a knee. The suitcase sits on the ground beside her. The girl, it appears, is grateful to be free of its weight for the time being. The girl pulls a bottle from the pocket of the army green coat, sets it into the obliging baby's mouth. She reaches for a book from the bottom shelf, and as I sneak into the nearest aisle, yanking some sci-fi thriller from the shelf and flipping to page 47, I hear her voice, softly reading aloud from Anne of Green Gables, while stroking the underside of the baby's toes. The baby is utterly calm. I spy through the metal shelves as the baby consumes the bottle, down to the residual bubbles at the bottom. And as she does, her eyes become too heavy to keep open, and they slowly, slowly drift closed, her body gravitating to dormancy, perfectly still with the exception of involuntary twitches here and there. Her mother continues to read, continues caressing the tiny toes with a thumb and forefinger. And suddenly I'm eavesdropping on a very personal moment between mother and child. A librarian appears. "Can I help you find something?" she asks, and I jump, clutching the sci-fi thriller in my hand. I feel guilty, flustered, my coat still dripping with rain. The librarian smiles, her features soft and kind. "No," I say quickly, quietly, I don't want to wake the baby. I whisper, "No, I just found it." And I hurry to the escalators and downstairs to check out my new book. I stop on the way home from work at the video store and rent a movie. A chick flick for Zoe and me, and a box of microwave popcorn, fat-free. Chris has always been a road warrior. As a young girl, Zoe was adversely affected by her here one minute, gone the next father. When he traveled, we would invent fun things to do when we couldn't be with Daddy. Movie nights and sleepovers in the big bed, pancakes for dinner, inventing stories in which Chris was a time traveler, much more entertaining, instead of a traveling investment banker. Boring. I take the elevator up to the fifth floor of our vintage building, and as I walk inside, I find it eerily quiet, strangely dark. Generally, it's the blaring sound of Zoe's stereo that greets me. But tonight it's silent. I flip on a lamp in the living room, call out her name. At her bedroom door, I knock. I can see the light leaking out under the door, but there's no response. I let myself inside. Zoe, still in her plaid uniform, which is a rarity these days, is sprawled across the creamy shag rug that lines the hardwood floors. Her uniform is usually discarded for something graphic. Something with sequins or rhinestone studs the minute she walks in the door. I can tell she is breathing, asleep, and so I don't panic. But I watch her, hugging that yellow notebook in her arms, lying aimlessly on the floor as if her body suddenly became too heavy to hold. She's wrapped in a plush blanket, her head propped on a throw pillow that reads, "Hugs and Kisses." Her space heater, which Chris bought after Zoe's many complaints that her bedroom was too cold, is set to 79 degrees. Her bedroom is a furnace, an oven, and Zoe, lying 2 feet away, is being cooked. Her cheeks are flushed. It's a wonder the blanket didn't catch fire. I hit the power button and turn the thing off, but it will take hours for the room to cool. My eyes deviate around the room, something Zoe would bark at if she were not asleep. The exposed brick walls that appear at random throughout the condo, the reason Chris deduced that Zoe's room was so cold. The unmade canopy bed with the patchwork quilt. The posters of teen celebs and tropical paradises mounted to the walls with putty. Her backpack is on the floor, spilled open. The granola bar I thrust into her hand before school for an after-school snack lying untouched. Balled-up notes from classmates are scattered upon the floor. The cats lie beside Zoe, embezzling the feverish heat for themselves. I run my hands through her long hair and quietly call her name once and then twice. When she comes to, she sits up at once, her eyes wide, as if she's been caught doing something wrong, something bad. She jumps to her feet, the cats falling to theirs, and tosses the blanket to her bed. "I was tired," she reasons, and her eyes dart around the room, wondering what, if any, transgressions I found. None. It's nearly 7 o'clock, and outside, somewhere behind the dark, plump clouds, the sun is beginning to set. Chris, in San Francisco, is likely sitting down to an outrageous dinner at some extravagant restaurant, studying Cassidy Knudsen across the table. I push the thought from my mind. "Then I'm glad you took a nap," I say, eyeing the creases across her cheek, her exhausted brown eyes. "How was your day?" "Fine," she says, snatching the yellow notebook from the floor. She clings to it like a baby lemur clinging to its mother's fur. "Was Mrs. Peters there?"
"No."
"She must really be sick," I say. "The flu, it appears, is peaking late this year. Same sob? The nag? Zoe nods. Yes, the nag. I'll start dinner, I tell Zoe, but to my surprise, she says, I already ate. Oh? I was hungry, after school. I didn't know what time you'd be home. That's fine, I tell her. What'd you have? Grilled cheese, she says, and then, for good measure, and an apple. Okay. I realize I still have on my raincoat, my rubber boots, and my bag is still draped across my body. I thrust my hand excitedly into the bag and produce the movie and popcorn. You up for a movie night? I ask. Just you and me? She's quiet, her face flat. No animated smile like the silly one on my own. I sense the no long before it appears. It's just, she starts. I have a test tomorrow. Mean, median, and mode. I drop the movie into my bag. So much for that idea. Then I can help you study, I suggest. That's okay. I made flashcards. And she shows them as proof. I try not to be overly sensitive because I know there was a time that I was 12, or 16 or 17, and would rather have had dental work than hang out with my mom. I nod. Okay, I say, and slip from the room. And as quiet as a mouse, she closes and locks the door behind me.
Chris. We're sitting in a hotel room, Henry, Tom, Cassidy, and me. It's my hotel room. There's a half-eaten box of pepperoni pizza. Meat? On top of the TV. Open cans of soda lying around the room. Henry's in the bathroom, taking a deuce, I think, because he's been in there so long. Tom is on the phone, in the corner, with a finger pressed in one ear so he can hear. There are pie charts and bar graphs spread across my bed. Dirty paper plates everywhere, on the table, on the floor. Cassidy's plate is on the end table, the one with the pepperoni plucked off and left in a neat pile beside her can of diet soda. I snag a piece of pepperoni and pop it in my mouth, and when she looks at me, I shrug and ask, "What? Heidi's gone meatless these days. I'm becoming protein deficient." "The New York strip steak didn't satisfy that craving?" she asks. She's smiling. A frisky sort of smile. Cassidy Knudsen is somewhere in her 20s, late 20s, right off an MBA. She's been working with us for about 10 months. She's a freaking genius, but not the awkward, nerdy type. The kind that can use words like fiduciary and hedging and actually sound cool. She's built like a lamppost, tall and thin, with a sphere at the top that glows. If I wanted my wife here, I would have brought her. She's sitting on the edge of my bed. She wears one of those pencil skirts with 3-inch heels. A woman of Cassidy's stature does not need 3-inch heels, which makes it all the more risque. She runs her hands through champagne hair, a sleek bob cut, and says to me, "Touché." Outside the window, the San Francisco skyline lights up the night. The heavy hotel curtains are open. From the right angle, we can see the Trans-America Pyramid. 555 California Street, and San Francisco Bay. It's after 9 o'clock. In the room next to us, the TV is loud, the sound of preseason baseball drifting through the walls. I pluck another piece of pepperoni from Cassidy's plate and listen. Giants are up, 3-2. Henry emerges from the bathroom, and we try hard to ignore the stench that follows. "Chris," he says, offering his cell phone in an outstretched hand. I wonder if he washed that hand. Wonder if he was on the phone the whole time he was in the bathroom. Henry isn't the classiest guy in the world. In fact, as he walks from the bathroom, I see that the fly of his trousers is down, and I would tell him, except that he just stunk up my room. "Aaron Swindler wants to talk to you." I take the phone from his hand and watch as he gropes for another slice of pizza, and quickly lose my appetite. It's no coincidence the prospective client's last name is Swindler. I put on my best salesman voice and saunter to my own corner of the cramped hotel room. "Mr. Swindler," I say, "how about them Giants?" Though from the catcalls in the adjoining room, I bet the Giants are no longer winning the game. I didn't always want to be an investment banker. When I was 6 years old, I had all sorts of lofty goals. An astronaut, a professional basketball player, a barber. It felt lofty at the time, kind of like a surgeon for hair. As I got older, it wasn't so much about the career itself, but how much it paid. I envisioned a penthouse on the Gold Coast, a fancy sports car, people looking up to me. My mind leaped to lawyers and doctors, pilots, but none of those interested me. By the time college rolled around, I had such a penchant for money that I majored in finance because it felt like the right thing to do. Sit in class with a bunch of other overindulged kids and talk about money. Money, money, money. That, in retrospect, is probably what enticed me the most about Heidi when we first met. Heidi didn't obsess with money like everyone else I knew. She obsessed with the lack of money, the have-nots versus the haves, where all I was concerned with was the haves. Who had the most money, and how could I get my hands on some? Aaron Swindler is going on and on about derivatives when I hear my own phone ring from across the room, where it lies on a striped comforter beside Cassidy and now Henry, who, 40 and notably single, is staring not so subtly at the sheer pantyhose on her legs. I'm waiting for an important call, one I can't miss, so I motion to her to answer it and hear her chant, "Hi there, Heidi," into the receiver. I deflate, like a helium balloon after a party. Shit. I hold up a finger to Cassidy. Hold on. But since Aaron Swindler won't stop talking about damn derivatives, I'm forced to listen to a protracted conversation between Cassidy and my wife about the flight to San Francisco, dinner at an expensive steakhouse, and the goddamn weather. Heidi has met Cassidy exactly 3 times. I know, because after each and every one of these meetings, I've been bombarded with the silent treatment, as if I had anything to do with her recruitment to our team, or her good looks for that matter. The first time they met was last summer at a work picnic at the Botanical Gardens. I'd never mentioned Cassidy to Heidi. She had only been working with us about 6 weeks. It didn't feel like the necessary or prudent thing to do. But as Cassidy sauntered near us in a long, strapless summer dress, where we hid in the shade of a maple tree on a 90-degree day, sweating and feeling totally gross, I saw Heidi grope awkwardly at a jean skirt and blouse, which she was clearly sweating through. I saw all shreds of self-confidence dissolve. "Who's that?" Heidi asked later, after the phony smiles and so-nice-to-meet-yous were through, after Cassidy had walked away in search of another happy marriage she could muddle. "Your secretary?" I never knew what Heidi meant by that. If it would have been better or worse if Cassidy Knudsen was my secretary. Later, at home, I caught Heidi pulling negligible gray hairs from her head with a pair of tweezers. Soon after, beauty products besieged our vanity, those laden with anti-wrinkle agents and age-defying vows. This is what I'm remembering as I thrust Henry's cell phone back at him, making sure to say, "Here you go, Henry," in a powerful tone so that Heidi, back home in Chicago, knows Cassidy and I are not alone, and flee into the hallway with my own phone. Heidi is a beautiful woman, don't get me wrong. Gorgeous. A person would never guess an entire decade sat between Cassidy and my wife. And yet, Heidi knew. "Hey," I say. "What was that all about?" she asks. I envision her at home, in bed, pajamas on, red flannel, or maybe the polka-dot nightgown Zoe picked out for her birthday. The bedroom TV is tuned into the news, her laptop spread across her legs. Heidi's hair is pulled up into one of those messy updos, anything to keep it out of her eyes, while she searches online for information on the slums of Dharavi or maybe poverty statistics from around the world. I don't know. Maybe when I'm not home she searches for porn. No, I change my mind. Not Heidi. Heidi is much too tasteful for porn. Maybe she's looking up some practical use for vegetarian meat crumbles. Cat food? Cat litter? What? I say dumbly, as if I hadn't noticed. The hotel hallway is covered with the most awful wallpaper, some kind of geometric red